The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
For today, I would like to also talk about the idea of practice being a journey, that it's a path we follow. And it's one of the common ways of presenting Buddhist practice in our tradition is that of a progressive path or journey that we follow. And sometimes Dharma talks themselves are a journey, that you kind of go, if you're able to go along with a talk, it kind of takes you on a journey. The stronger your imagination is maybe, the more you can kind of feel like you're part of it. And I would like to present this idea of a journey, of a path today through three steps, describe how it unfolds. And there's many different ways of doing this description, different perspectives for it. So the three steps are to go from what I'm going to call today from, well, I'll say this, that one of the primary things that mindfulness practice can do is shift the way we see the world. So rather than having a new experience, it's often focused on seeing our experience in a new way. And many people involved are looking for a better experience, which you can have for sure. And sometimes meditation can change, you make you calmer and happier, and your experience in some ways is better. But the most radical transformation has to do with a new vision, where we see our life in a new way. And having a vision not only of our life, but also a vision that allows us to see in a new way, or see a purpose for our life in a new way, a potential. And so to get to that vision, we have to overcome some of the limited perspectives that we live under. And so often we live under certain perspectives. We have ways of seeing already. And those perspectives need to be quieted down or cleared so that we're not seeing through those perspectives anymore. And so that and the way to do that is through what's called bhavana, which is mental cultivation, or we just call it practice. And so to go from perspectives to having the clarity to have a new vision of things, we cultivate, develop the mind in a certain way. And that's the journey that I'm going to talk about today, to go from perspectives to cultivation to having a vision. So perspectives that we live under, there's a ton of them. But what I mean by this today is that we have a preconception about how to interpret what our experience is. As we go into our life and follow our life, we carry with us ideas that we maybe inherited from our society or from our family, from past experience. And so we have a certain prejudice, a certain preconception about how we see experience. And the kind of the fairy tale example for this in Western culture is the ugly duckling. The ugly duckling made a premature cognitive commitment. And so she, this little duckling, first thing she saw, first a swan was born, right, and this baby swan, but the first thing she saw was a duck. And she thought, that's my mother. That was the first premature cognitive commitment. And then lived with this perspective, that's my mom. And then thinking that, then she thought she was a duck, and she looked so different than all the other ducks. And therefore, she concluded she was an ugly duckling. Maybe the second premature cognitive commitment. Until someone pointed out, you're not a duck, you're a swan. So she saw herself who she was, and turns out that she's a beautiful swan in the end. And so how often do we live under these premature cognitive commitments? That we see ourselves, we see our world through a certain filter, and it limits the full potential. We don't see clearly what's here. I used to live in Davis, in California, and went to college there, and I biked everywhere. I didn't have a car. And in the wintertime, it used to be cold in central California, and we used to have this tule fog in the morning. It was very, very biting cold. And I wasn't that, you know, that didn't occur to me to get gloves. And my hands would get really cold in the morning. It'd be freezing cold. So cold that when I got to class, my first class, I couldn't properly hold my pencil to take notes because my hand was still so stiff from the cold. So you can imagine it was pretty biting. And so I used to bike to school and consider how miserable I was. Poor Gil. Me and my poor life and my hands are cold and it wasn't a very creative form of self misery because I could have gotten gloves, but I didn't think of it. So I had this, and then one day I was biking to school, feeling sorry for myself and my poor hands. And then I remembered that when I was a young teenager, I had gone skiing a few times. I remember, when I went skiing, my hands sometimes felt exactly the same way. But I was elated. I was, energized. I was delighted. And I said, what's going on here? The same sensations, the same stiffness in my hands. And in one perspective, I'm miserable. And the other perspective, I'm elated. I mean, it has to do with the context, right? But the information that was coming in was the same. I saw a one perspective led to one way, one perspective led to another way. Or imagine maybe a parent, maybe some of you are parents, have been parents of young kids, but you're walking around by yourself alone, and a swarm of bees comes close to you, starts kind of getting too close, maybe attacking you or something. It's a big deal. And so maybe fear is the first response, and running away. Oh my God, this is terrible! This is dangerous! Oh, or maybe a little barking dog coming out. I was walking here today, and this dog came racing at me, barking today. So oh. But then imagine yourself, because you're a parent, you're with your little kid. At the same situation, the bees come, the dog come, and then for some parents, the first instinct would be not to be afraid, but to be protective, to be ferocious, maybe to be a certain kind of anger even, and kind of like, okay, I've got to deal with this, I've got to stop this dog, stop these bees, let's get out of here. But it's a whole different response than when we're alone. Same situation, but different context. So we can have the same experiences and see it through different lenses at different times. And are some of them the right lens, some of them the wrong lens? I don't know. But many lenses, many perspectives that we bring often can bring a lot of suffering to ourselves and to the world around us. And Mark talked about the Undoing Racism workshop that he wants to put on. And this is needed because there's a lot of people in our society who suffer a tremendous amount by these premature cognitive commitments where people are seen through certain perspectives. And then the people who are seen that way unfortunately have to kind of live with the consequences of being seen that way, and it's very painful. And we can do that ourselves as well. We can, probably many of us are the equivalent of the ugly duckling. Many people in our society think poorly about themselves and don't see their beauty, don't see that they're a swan in their own way. And so we get stuck in this perspective of who we are. And so in some of these perspectives that we live under are not seen as perspectives, meaning that they're seen as being inherent in the situation. They're taken for granted. It's kind of like an accurate understanding of the world that we live in. And we don't see that these are concepts that are operating our mind that have overlaid our eyes, and we see through them, and we're not seeing accurately. We think we're seeing accurately, but it's just this concept that's overlays the situation. So then, and these can get a swirl of different perspectives and concepts and ideas, sometimes competing ones, and the mind can be spinning around because they lend themselves to further preoccupation, further, often reactivity. The cognitive thinking mind can get quite claustrophobic when it lives under these concepts that we project onto the world and take them to be real as they are. One of the important values of mindfulness, and one of the reasons why it can be so radical for many people, is it teaches us to question how we, the perspective we have on our world, question the concepts that we put on top of it, the judgments we have. And one of the part of this radical ability starts with a very simple step, which is to stop and look. Just stop, pause. And don't race ahead with the ideas, but have a little question mark. Is this really so? What am I doing right now? What's happening right now? What's my mind doing right now? What's my feelings doing right now? And if you learn that stop and to look, you can start seeing the functioning of concepts, functioning of ideas. You can see how perspectives are being projected onto the world around us, onto ourselves. It's quite a radical thing to do, to start seeing that. But it requires some kind of stopping. To support that, we have what's called bhavana, and that's a Buddhist word meaning cultivation. And we cultivate the mind. We engage in a practice, and one of the functions of practice is to clear the mind. when the mind is in a swirl of preoccupation and thoughts and projections, it's nice to clear it so that our sight becomes clear. And one of the meanings of vipassana is clear seeing. We're cultivating the ability to see clearly. One of the ways that that's done is by calming down and concentrating the mind, stilling the mind. And it's one of the beautiful qualities of heart, mind that can be developed, cultivated through practice, is having a mind that's in a heart, whichever you prefer the word, that becomes able to be quiet and still. Not quiet and still because it goes numb or becomes dead or something, but the kind of quiet and stillness where there's greater clarity, greater wisdom, greater creativity. We're not caught up in the swirls of reactivity, swirls of desire and hate and fear. The mind is not spinning. So to have the mind quiet down. And so one of the reasons, important part of this path of practice then, is to do something like meditation practice, to do mindfulness practice that supports us to quiet down, to clear the space in our mind. And so it's done partly by this kind of more thorough stopping, a stopping of sitting down to meditate, to sit for 30 minutes, 45 minutes, and not to continue the incessant movement of the mind, activities of the mind, but to quiet down and just stop, to let it quiet down. A fair amount of the quieting and clearing of the mind will happen by itself if we just give itself a chance, give the mind a chance. And so if we stop and sit down and stop kind of chasing after thoughts, chasing after emotions, or keep involving ourselves in our concerns, the mind will quiet down, the heart will quiet, the heart will soften. And so just simply stopping and doing nothing is very radical. But we also have particular practices within meditation practice that help this movement of concentration. One of them is to yoke the mind, kind of bring the mind in contact with something very simple, so that the energy of the mind is not kind of has free rein to go off into our thoughts and concerns, but the energy of the mind can stay focused on something very simple, which helps this process of settling and quieting and clearing. One of the common ways that focuses of mind to do this is breathing. Just simply stay with the breath. Stay with the breath. Mind wanders off, come back and stay with the breath. Don't worry if the mind wanders off, because every time you come back to the breath, you're slowly undoing the energy of preoccupation, the energy of drifting off into these thoughts, into these concepts, these premature cognitive commitments that we keep get pulled into. So just come back to something as simple as the breathing. Breathing, breathing. It also is helpful if you start enjoying the meditation practice. And there's an art in the practice of meditation to look for the pleasure, to look for where the ease, the comfort, to look for where the joy is, the well-being, the sense of well-being that might be there. It might take a while, but it might happen in a 30-minute or 45-minute meditation. Somewhere near the end, you feel more settled, contented than you were when you started, more relaxed. Take time to notice that, to appreciate that, because the more you can appreciate it, the more you can recognize it, the more it tends to support that to happen more often. It comes along more. It's like a signpost along the way that says, "Oh, this is the path. This is the way forward." Is to have the sense of in the present moment, sense of well-being here. So part of this clearing the mind is supported by having a sense of well-being as we meditate. Sometimes a sense of well-being can be quite strong. It's a great sense of delight and joy, happiness. Sometimes a sense of peace and calm and all that. The other part of this mental cultivation is to become, and this is where mindfulness becomes very important, is that we want to become self-aware about all the little tricks the mind has, how the mind works, how we get the ways in which we get caught up in thoughts, the ways that we react, the ways that we get caught up in preoccupations. So it could be some simple as I'm sitting and meditating and I'm going to stay with my breathing the best I can. And I notice after a period of time, maybe it's only 30 seconds into it, that I'm not doing very well. I was supposed to follow my breath and I didn't. Or I did for 2 breaths and then I haven't done enough for 5 minutes. So you try again and you same thing happens again. So here, in a conventional sense, you've failed at what you set yourself to do. Well, first of all, you look and see, what is your mind doing in this situation? What's the whole ecosystem of the mind involved in? To see it as a failure is a choice, it's a perspective. That's not necessary. So maybe you have a tendency to look for success and failure. Maybe you have high expectations that you should be able to do things in a particular way, and that expectation, when it's not fulfilled, leaves you to be disappointed and feeling like a failure. That's very important to see how that works. And then you might decide you're going to try harder. Your approach in response to failing is to try harder. So you bear down. I'm going to really kind of tense up to relax. You're going to tense up and really kind of stay on that breath. So you see, oh, that's what your tendency is. That's what I do. I tend to tense up and try harder. Or perhaps you notice that you feel like a failure because you didn't follow the breath. So you just give up. Oh, well, I just sit here. It's hopeless anyway, but I'm not supposed to leave the hall. So I guess I'll just sit here and think about, I wonder what's on television tonight. Or something, or think about fantasizing about something. Just I give up. So the path of mindfulness is see, my tendency is to give up and wander off and entertain myself in fantasy. Or my tendency is to get angry, or my tendency is to be afraid, my tendency, and to see how these operate. This is crucial in this path of cultivation because we want to become wise about what's going on for ourselves. In all the different ways, how we operate in the mind. Only then can the path to peace be realistic. It's not very helpful to do spiritual bypass and to chase after good feelings, spiritual feelings, good experiences too quickly and bypass the whole process of deeper and deeper self-understanding, what's actually going on. So we do this concentration practice, and part of the function of concentration practice is, if I can use it kind of without using the word too seriously, part of the function of concentration practice is to fail at it. Because when you kind of don't succeed, that's a fantastic opportunity to use mindfulness to see, learn about yourself and how you react and how you respond. And then see if you can learn in a more effective, useful way of coming back on the breath, landing on it in a peaceful way or calm way, learning patience, learning not to be reactive and not to be caught up in self-judgments that might come up. Just, oh, look at that, mind wandered away, I'll come back again. Mind wandered away, I'll come back again. So this process of cultivation that we do, this is a slow process, and hopefully it's an enjoyable process, and something that's well worth doing. Then, as the mind gets clear, as our ability to see the inner life and the outer life without the filter of a lot of these preconceived perspectives that we bring on it, then at some point we enter into what's called in Buddhism sometimes the path of vision. We attain vision. And this is the word, some of you know a little bit about Indian religions, know the word darshana, that's just kind of a Sanskrit or Hindu word. You have darshan, means you go and you sit in the presence often of a guru who's supposed to have a certain kind of attainment that's quite impressive to sit with. You have darshan with the teacher. It means to have to see the teacher. But the same word is used in Buddhism for a different term, different purpose. It's pronounced slightly different because of a different dialect. Dasana maga, the path of seeing, path of having a vision. And what is it we have a vision for? What can we have? What can we see that is not a perspective that we bring onto the experience? And one of the things we can see is we can see the absence of these concepts that we overlay on top of the world. We can see how in the past we had all these ideas, all these judgments, all these reactions to experience. We can see how all those kind of made things more complicated than they need to be, how they didn't help us to see clearly. And then we can see that these concepts are no longer there, that we're not overlaying. Seeing the absence of these perspectives, these conceptions, these fixed ideas, you can see how valuable that is. You can see the freedom of mind that comes with that. You can see the value of seeing the world with this fresh perspective. How good it feels in the heart and the mind not to be weighed down or constricted by all the swirl of concept ideas we carry with us. So it's not so much adaptation of a new perspective, but rather it's appreciating what it's like when a lot of these old perspectives have dropped away. And what happens as a consequence? And one of the things that happens as a consequence is we see ourselves in a new way. To see ourselves in a calm, settled way with the mind clear, we see ourselves as swans. We see ourselves as beautiful beings. Because in our hearts, there's a tremendous beauty within us that's waiting for us. This tremendous, it's a treasure, a tremendous inner wealth that awaits us. And it's hard to imagine it when life has been hard and there's been a lot of challenges over a lifetime that gives us a very strong perspective that we think this is how things are. No one likes me. Everyone kind of is out to get me, or I have to kind of take care of myself, or I have to kind of hide away because no one should get to know me. And all these kinds of ideas that people can live by are very limiting. But to be able to sit in meditation, for example, and have all those fall away, and to see ourselves in a radical different way, free of all the old ideas, is a phenomenal thing to do. In Buddhism, we say it's liberating, it's freeing. But part of the function of that freedom is to give us a vision of what's possible. And it's a vision of it's possible to live with the mind, the heart, free of all these heavy ideas and concepts, perspectives that we have so quickly overlaid on top of the experience. It's possible to live without the overlay of reactive emotions, and seeing through the filter of all these reactive emotions, our anxiety, our anger, our hostility, our fear, our confusion, our doubts, our desires, our lust, all these things, we don't have to see through those, because we see, we've had the experience, maybe temporarily, of we've seen what it's like without that. It's possible. And it feels really good to be alive. It not only does it feel good, but it feels very meaningful. It feels very different. It feels like just to be alive is enough, to be present. Whereas if we live through the all concepts and ideas, just to be alive is not enough. We need more. We need less. We need, things have to be different. This can't be good enough. And we're constantly negotiating and finding out what we want to do. For me, it's very powerful, the idea, that little kind of the metaphor, that many people live their lives rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. You know, constantly, you know, shifting and changing and, you know, trying to make it all work. Meditation is like, you know, you jump off and get on the ocean liner which is not sinking. You know, stop it. You know, it's okay, you know, deck chairs. Leave the deck chairs alone. You don't have to go down with, let them go down. Don't you go down with the ship. Go where it's safe. Actually, the metaphor in Buddhism wouldn't be you go on another different ship. It would be you go on dry land where it's safe and stable. So to have a vision that this is possible. Also to have a vision of what it's like then to meet the world with this clear mind, with a clear heart. And the tendency, I believe, for most people is then we want to meet the world ethically, with integrity. Because generally most forms of unethical activity arise when people's minds are not clear, or when their hearts are not clear, when they're not settled and at peace with themselves. And often unethical behavior is often motivated by trying to deal with or trying to respond to or react to or cope with some deep inner turmoil and, you know, being caught up in all these expectations and shoulds and needs and desires and fears and angers that people have. And so as all these become, all this quiet down and the inner clarity begins to shine, tendency is to want to live ethically. For no other reason sometimes that to, you know, why would you take something which is clean? You know, you spend all this work cleaning your clothes and you don't immediately go out and pick up mud from the garden and wipe it on your shirt. You know, just like, you know, you kind of wait, you know, to make, you know, it's like, why would you have a clean mind and then soil it? It kind of doesn't feel good. It actually feels painful. And so the motivation to be ethical maybe isn't ethical, exactly immoral. It's just because you have this felt sense inside that to move in that direction, you harm yourself. You lose the clarity, the peaceful place that we have. So there's a vision of ourselves. We see ourselves in a new way. We see a possibility, a potential. We see the... We can see the effect that different mind states and activities have, and that in seeing that, having a vision of that, we see the potential of harm, we see the potential of freedom and lack of harm. So the same thing with the world around us. We can have a new vision of the world when the mind is clear. When we have an experience of ourselves with a clear mind, clear heart, and it feels so good to have this peace, well-being, settledness just here, and we know this for ourselves, if we know it well enough, it gives us a vision for what's possible for other people. Or to say it differently, we have a vision of the beauty that's in everyone. And so there's a different way of seeing the people around us. Rather than seeing people as a threat or as objects of desire or as annoyances or as someone to be afraid of, it's quite something to shift the vision and see in such a way that we have a profound appreciation of the people, other people, where we see the potential or see into their hearts in a sense and see that they're beautiful. There's wonderfulness there. There's treasures there. And to have that resonate with the clarity that we have and kind of see. Sometimes you can see it in other people and they don't even see it themselves. But it's really wonderful to, it's a great gift to the world, to others, is to see them with appreciation. Even appreciate what's there, even if they don't see it themselves yet. And so it lends itself to a vision, not only of how to see other people, but also a vision for a more peaceful society. A vision that we don't have to live constantly in conflict. We can have a vision of living in harmony, or living in concord, living as a family together, all of us. And it's not because there's a should, it's not because there's a moral imperative, you should treat everyone equally or something, but I think it's a natural consequence of how the heart responds to the world or sees the world with this new vision of clarity, of peacefulness, of settledness, where we're no longer caught up in preoccupations, caught up in attachments and clinging. And so we go from having these premature cognitive commitments, these preconceived perspectives that we don't even see as perspectives, but we go from there through a path of settling the mind, clearing the mind, opening the heart, and what gets born is a new vision. New vision of what's possible, new vision of what's here, new vision of a different way of living. And then it's a matter of living that way. And that new vision that gets born through practice can give people a very profound sense of purpose. That this is valuable. This is one of the most important things a person can do, is to cultivate and develop and develop further this vision and live a life from this vision. And many of the other ways that people had seemed purposeful before, you realize how much they were involved in complicated concepts and ideas, shoulds and shouldn'ts, and kind of the deck chairs kind of thing. And to be able to be on dry ground and really see a possibility and see how good this is, how much goodness there is, how much rightness there is in this new vision, for some people, then gives them the central purpose of their lives. This is what's helpful. This is what's valuable. And it's good to have a life of purpose. But to have a life of purpose that arises out of the heart in a deep place, I think, is one of the great things of life. So, and the last point I'll make to repeat is that in this whole process, one of the really crucial aspects of it is take the time to get to know yourself better. And as you know yourself better, see if you can do that with as much clarity and simplicity as possible. So if you have, if you start knowing how your mind works and your reactions work and your thoughts work and all that, and you see that some of them are not so exemplary. They're not what you think it should be. Then we're training ourselves to see those things with kindness, clarity, and simplicity, with patience. Don't overlay more painful perspectives on top of what's already painful. But try to just clear the air. Oh, just see it. Oh, just like this. It's like this. It's okay. It's okay. And then there's a path you follow through that process. And things will unfold and change as you stop and take a good, better look at what goes on. So that's a journey. And I don't know if any of you followed that journey today, if you could relate to it all in yourself. But we have about 5 minutes. If some of you would like to ask questions or make comment about this, or it would be lovely to hear from some of you.
Good morning. You're talking about, understanding yourself more clearly and having a vision. And then you're talking about people feeling like they should do this and they shouldn't do that, that's part of this the deck furniture on the Titanic. But I think maybe because there's so much more information now, what's going on in the world, we know more things. What if you feel you should do something for the benefit of other people? Where does that come in, you know?
Well, I think the operative word that you're asking is should.
Uh-huh.
And that's a perspective.
Yeah.
And so the process that I was talking about is, over time, is a capacity to shift from a should to a desire.
Uh-huh.
And at some point it becomes a natural desire.
Mm-hmm.
Or impulse or response
uh-huh.
that, oh, I think I'd like to do something about this.
Yeah.
If you live with shoulds, then there's a very long list.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I will guarantee you
yeah.
that if you follow every should that occurs to you,
yeah.
You will, be exhausted very quickly.
Yeah.
So it's counterproductive.
Uh-huh.
So it's a little bit complicated about the should. We have to be a little bit careful how we talk about this. If you make a commitment with someone,
mm-hmm.
then we can say, yeah, I should follow the commitment. Uh-huh. Otherwise, things get complicated.
Yeah.
But in terms of responding to the world, the suffering of the world, I would like everyone to respond. I mean, I've kind of based my whole life on the idea that teaching Buddhism transforms people to become better citizens and mm-hmm. to make a better mm-hmm. life for all of us. So mm-hmm. That's what I believe.
Yeah.
But I would like it to be the natural outgrowth out of this, the natural response of the heart,
uh-huh.
rather than I've seen so many people carry along the idea that we're obligated.
Uh-huh.
And so one way to explore this for yourself is if you are reading the news and mm-hmm. finding out what's going on in the world and
yeah.
Feel, oh, I should do something that's important. However long time you're learning about the world in the news, that's how long you should meditate.
Oh, okay.
You should meditate. You see
right,
how you say
it?
if you meditate as much as you're concerned yeah. with all these things, it might shift your understanding. It might help you kind of settle some of your perspectives and see with more clarity.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe you'll come from inspiration. It's much better to come from inspiration and joy than it is to come from obligation. And I think it's possible to respond effectively
mm-hmm.
and powerfully from inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
That in the big picture, I think, is better than coming from obligation.
Yeah. Now, what if you're in the middle of doing something? Is there some checkup question you could ask? Am I doing a should or am I doing an inspiration? Is there some way to look at what I'm doing so I can kind of say, well, is it this way or that way? I mean, if you're
yeah.
if you're describing it, it sounds great, but if you're the person, sometimes you don't know.
Yeah, great question. I think a very useful part of mindfulness is practice mindfulness of the body.
Mm-hmm.
And the more sensitive you are to your physical experience as you go through life,
mm-hmm.
The quicker you'll notice the tensions that arise, the stress, uh-huh. physical stresses that arise,
mm-hmm.
that indication that we're a little bit off in how we're approaching things.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're caught up in a sense of obligation and caught in that, chances are you'll feel tightness in your eyes and your jaws and your shoulders and your stomach somewhere,
yeah.
or in your brain.
Mm.
And you can watch the functioning of your mind starting to go fast and tight and,
mm-hmm.
And kind of... the thoughts have kind of come along furiously one after the other. I should do this. I have to do something right now.
Yeah.
Whereas with what I'm calling inspiration, it's possible to stay at rest and calm.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a great example of this is Mahatma Gandhi. And he worked tirelessly for the liberation of India
mm-hmm.
From the British and other things. Someone asked him how he could do so as much as he did. And he said he was always at rest.
Huh? Okay.
So being at rest, it doesn't mean that we become, couch potatoes.
Yeah. Thanks a lot.
So one more and then we'll stop.
Thank you. That was very insightful. I just want to bring back to kind of the news. I was spending time on Twitter to get a pulse of how people were reacting to the terrorist attacks in Nice. And
The
terrorist attacks in Nice.
In France, yes.
In France, yeah.
Yeah, your home country.
I'm French. But of everything, I saw this tweet, and it was a quote from Voltaire, and it was saying how people who can believe absurdities are the same people who can commit atrocities. And then I was listening to a talk by Thich Nhat Hanh, and I was realizing that, you know, what you are describing today is really that this practice is a way to not read this quote and feel they are them who can commit atrocities, but to realize that in each of us, we can actually believe absurdities, every single one of us. And this practice is taking that filter, you know, off. And that's kind of, you know, a door to really kind of really connect, you know. I mean, I've seen things that were disturbing as people saying, there's only one person dead for all those other, you know, innocent that are dead. And, you know, I'm a little speechless about this, but the talk that you were giving, I felt was very powerful in kind of connecting to what every single one of us can do and really stop believing that the people who believe absurdities are others.
Right.
They are the terrorists. I mean, all around us and every one of us are believing absurdities. Yeah.
So I think it's right, and I think that part of the value of this practice of mindfulness is to notice how much absurdity is in our own minds and our capacity to have all kinds of thoughts. And so the more we can understand and see that and hold it lightly with humor, with compassion, with just... and then we can... That's part of the vision. Say, oh, no, it's so easy to go there. It's so easy for others to go there. But I know in myself, under that, there's depth of something beautiful, wonderful. And I know in that person, there's also depth of something wonderful. And so we have to be very careful not to turn our backs to people. And many times in our society, people turn we turn our backs on people and condemn people. And I think that my ideal is that as we deepen our practice in Buddhism, we come to a place where we never turn our backs on anyone. They might have to go to jail or something, but we don't turn our backs. We kind of see the possibility. And so thank you for bringing up what happened in France. And I struggle a little bit today, or this week, wondering what to talk about. The talk and stuff in France weighed heavily on me. But, you know, just last week I talked about Dallas. And I just thought, well, I don't think I'd want to just talk about the next tragedy the week later, but I'm going to address it indirectly. So whether you heard it or not, this was an indirect way of dealing with this. Same thing.
So, that's wonderful. I saw one, painting or piece of art that really resonated with me, and it was a French flag, and then next to it, I have to translate to French, maybe it was in English, but I only saw the French version, and it was saying, I'm Charlie, I'm Paris, I'm Brussels, I'm Orlando, I'm London, I'm Nice, I'm Bangladesh, I'm exhausted. and that was, you know, we all have this inside.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, we take care of ourselves, for sure. And again, for the people who have the capacity for meditation, this is a way of dealing with exhaustion so that that doesn't linger and stay and weigh us down. It's a way of clearing out, not so that we forget, but we can keep being fresh and keep responding and seeing in clear ways. So I think this ability to, this cultivation part of Buddhism is really important. It's the bridge that really takes us from challenges of our life to solutions. Great. Thank you.